I want to cover a lot of bases today. First, I want to respond positively and with enthusiasm to an overture from my wonderful son-in-law, Dan Siskind, who, along with my daughter Meredith and my grandson Asher, are visiting all the way from Australia. Last June, for my birthday, Dan gave me a book. Now, I must admit that ministers are always receiving books. I have been given self-help books that folks said would improve me, political books that were supposed to make me more aware, classics that I somehow missed. A congregant once gave me a copy of Tolstoy's War and Peace, and about a week later asked when we could get together to discuss its various meanings. But this was a bit different. The book, Age of the Atheists, by British author Peter, well, he's author, historian, journalist, Peter Watson, is basically an intellectual history of the Western world over the last 135 years. That was the year the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche published a popular book, Thus Spake Zarathustra, in which a madman runs wildly into town screaming, God is dead. He then goes on to add, we have killed him. This was not the first time Nietzsche had made or issued a death warrant, to a divine death warrant. But Zarathustra's terse popular style attracted lots of attention. There were lots of cultural influences, modern biblical criticism, the theory of evolution being among the strongest, but somehow 1882 became a turning point. Belief in God, the literally interpreted God of the Jewish and Christian scriptures, had been declining for centuries, and for some had never made sense. But following Zarathustra, openly declaring one's disbelief became socially acceptable. Making sense of life, on the other hand, finding one's existential bearings with some joie de vivre and opportunities for meaningful endeavor, that remained. God or no God, people are hardwired to make sense of life. Peter Watson's book outlines the leading secular philosophic traditions of the last 135 years since disbelief started being respectable and over the decades more and more openly shared. Now, Dan, my scientifically trained son-in-law, is himself an atheist. So was my humanities-trained mentor in liberal ministry, Paul W. Sawyer. But just as there are many kinds of believers, they're Baptists, they're Methodists, they're Hindus, they're, you know, people, all kinds of people who call themselves believers, well, in just the same way, there are many, many, many kinds of atheists. Paul Sawyer consulted the Book of Changes, or I Ching, Chinese oldest book in the world. He consulted it every day. He read the poets. He himself was a poet. He maintained long-standing, disciplined spiritual practices and had a mystical streak. He told me that Frederick Spiegelberg, who taught world religions at Star King Seminary, was founder of what's today the Institute of Integral Studies in the Bay Area, and is outlined in this book. Paul told me that Friedrich Spiegelberg had taught him and a generation of UU ministers that if you do not visualize God with a human face, then you're an atheist. And so, like I said, there are lots of kinds of atheists. 600 pages worth. Right here. And I cannot go into every one of them. Watson focuses on about 100 serious Western culture makers, poets, artists, scientists, writers, psychologists, and philosophers, And he also talks about on who influenced who, what others, leading to various kind of schools of thought that have developed over the decades, all of which celebrate life and offer deep meaning without recourse to the supernatural. Now, I should say that, just by way of talking about a little bit about myself, or so you get a handle on who I am, what I'm as interpreter of all this, but I generally call myself a theist, but about half the people in this book are very, you know, I wouldn't have called them atheists. I don't know how. But anyway, now I do know how, and I understand it better. So, and theist or not, I don't believe in anything supernatural. It's all natural. Everything is natural. If it's not natural, it's not. I don't believe. Friedrich Nietzsche himself was an atheist. But he was hardly hopeless or nihilistic. His prescription for a world without God, in which he and all the rest of us, to some extent, find ourselves, was to live in a Dionysian, grand style, reaching an intensity of daily experience so invigorating that you'd do it again and again with no misgivings. Sort of like Jim Morrison of the Doors, it seems to me, or Janis Joplin, always out on the edge, pushing the envelope. Many of Nietzsche's contemporaries agreed. Modern-day Dionysians, or then-modern-day Dionysians, who in fact gave birth to modern dance. At Ascona, in the Italian Alps, a community sprang up in the 1880s, 90s, and turn of the century. This community at Ascona was totally in that spirit of ecstatic revelry. Rudolf Laban, Mary Wigman, and others inspired the likes of Isadora Duncan, who exclaimed for all of them their aim, to forget the form and dance the reason why. It's not unlike our, you know, Jasmine, was it? No, it was the opening, the monster man, my three keys, yeah. And she said, dance like nobody's looking. So Isadora Duncan went one further. Dance, the reason why, you know, the bottom line reason. Many of Nietzsche's contemporaries agreed. D.H. Lawrence, Franz Kafka, Hermann Hesse, Carl Jung were all habitués at Ascona. The curriculum was mostly dance and kind of physical movement oriented, but also, and more intently, it was about finding that reason why and marshaling the courage to live it every day. For this was Nietzsche's main point, the need in a godless universe to focus less on content with more focus, more energy, more attention paid to expression, basically self-expression. Feelings for Nietzsche and these others following were as important as facts. It's not that facts aren't important, it's not even dismiss facts, but our feelings in making a decision, like my psychotherapist, Aunt Fran, used to always say, well, it'd be irrational to make an important decision without consulting your feelings, wouldn't it? So feelings are as important as facts. And getting in touch with them and learning how to give expression to them is, for many of these people, the essence of their theology, philosophy, contract with life. Now, he goes, when he talks about some of these schools, let me point some of them out. And the first one, which he clearly loves, and it inspired me in all my research and understanding, is what he's calling the phenomenological approach, started in the 20s, really, by Edmund Husserl, also expanded by Martin Heidegger, these 20th century German philosophers. Phenomenology can be defined as understanding life as an inexhaustible number of experiences and appreciating each experience's individuality and concreteness. This is kind of what poets do, you know, seeing in this rose, in this scene out my bedroom window, in this morning light, it refracts a deeper beyond, or it crystallizes all morning light, or so something on that order, but focusing on the concrete specific, not on the abstract general, which is what more often science does, to reduce, in a way, life. I don't want to reduce a bad word, but simplify life to abstract major principles, 4 or 5 or 6. We're still looking for how do we unify theory, get a unified field theory. But what the poets and what the phenomenologists are asking us to do is focus rather on the concrete, on this little piece of paper. So the phenomenologists. There's also, even bigger really, as a developing way of understanding reality, is what he calls the psychological approach. And he starts on that with William James, he's a brother of Henry James, the author, and he was a professor at Harvard from 1890 to 1910, that great philosophy. Well, he started out as a professor of psychology. He was an MD, like my son-in-law, but he also ended up getting a PhD in psychology, and he ended up teaching philosophy at Harvard for a long time. And he was generally understood as the kind of principal spokesperson for what we call pragmatism, philosophical school of pragmatism, kind of a secular equivalent to faith in God. Pragmatism involves faith in the human community and its evolving institutions. And I think a lot of you use are pragmatists in that way. It's not, you know, God is, whether God is here or not is not so critical, but we do have faith in human institutions and in human beings. And we try to live that faith. I have this little first edition of Varieties of Religious Experience, and it writes. And here's the thing that keeps getting elaborated here. The trouble with the scientific approach, well, one trouble with the totally is coming only out of a scientific understanding of reality is that it ignores certain aspects that are discontinuous with physics and calculus. So, James writes, our normal waking consciousness is but one special type of consciousness, while all about it, parted from it by the filmiest of screens, there lie potential forms of consciousness entirely different. We may go through life without suspecting their existence, but apply the requisite stimulus, and at a touch, they are there in all their completeness. Different types of mentality, which probably somewhere have their field of application and adaptation. No account of the universe in its totality can be final, which leaves these other forms of consciousness quite disregarded. How to regard them is the question, for they're so discontinuous with ordinary consciousness. They may determine attitudes, though they cannot furnish formulas, and open a region, though they fail to give a map. At any rate, and here's the main point and the conclusion of his thought, at any rate, they forbid a premature closing of accounts with reality. And it's that effort to kind of deal with these altered states of consciousness, paranormal parts of reality, those pieces that can't be measured and weighed. It's that effort that is part of the genesis of the religious impulse and of the psychologists who try to understand it in non-divine terms. Peter Watson repeatedly suggests that for most modern people, psychology has replaced religion as the key to understanding what's really happening in our lives. And this started with Freud, who published about 110 years ago now, The Interpretation of Dreams, another altered state. And that became the whole kind of main first big piece of psychoanalysis and gained respectability in the intellectual community of Europe and the world. But Freud was just the beginning. There's also Jung, Otto Rank, who wrote about birth trauma and how it affects our lives, and Victor Adler, whose whole thing was on the that people's will to power for him, as for Nietzsche, was the basis of our efforts to be. Jung, C.G. Jung's psychology, bloomed into a fully developed mystical understanding of human identity, with a bookshelf long of books all about alchemy and all this stuff it's hard to get your handle on, but he keeps revolving back and forth the world, dream life, other visions, where are they, what do they do, how do they fit in? But there were atheists, and they're all atheists, according to Peter Watson. There were atheists, however, who were entirely different and who had anything but mystical views. Watson writes at length about the Bolshevik crusade for scientific atheism and also on what he calls the Nazi religion of blood. A word about the scientific atheism of the Soviets. Their big error, it seems to me, was that they thought that, oh, as soon as we expose how funky, you know, religion is, people will just abandon it and they'll flock to dialectical materialism, which was kind of their theology. But it doesn't work like that. Freud thought the same thing. As soon as I help people understand the genesis of their neuroses, then they'll just abandon them. Oh, but it's not that easy, because we're programmed and we have these habits, culturally and individually. That was the Bolsheviks, but also it's all of us. Reading about the Soviet atheism and Nazi atheism, I kept thinking, okay, we've all grown used to the idea of a godless universe. But these guys, at the tops of those cultures, believed in a loveless universe as well. And maybe that's, at bottom, what atheism really is. Hard to think about. In its darkest form, yes. In the wake of World War II, and with the awareness following the war of the terrible atrocities that have been unleashed, belief in God was further eroded. As Nobel Prize-winning author Elie Wiesel put it, "My God died when I got off the train at Auschwitz." Wiesel's faith didn't completely die, however. Like Jacob, he's been wrestling the night long through ever since. At 50 and 55 years plus later, his ideas about life and the cosmos are still evolving. It was about this time, right after World War II, incidentally, that existentialism emerged, espoused most prominently by the writers Anton de Saint-Exupéry, Albert Camus, and Jean-Paul Sartre. "Be responsible," wrote the existentialists. "Enjoy. Be responsible. Take charge of your life. Own your errors and your gifts. And enjoy the warmth you managed to create by marshaling your energies. Enjoy it and be proud." Essentially, what the existentialists ask of us, or suggest, or recommend, is be an artist in your own life. Another atheistic development is well known and was actually lived through, probably, I know, by some of you. In the mid-1960s, Cal State professor Theodore Roszak wrote a book, which I read at the time, The Making of a Counterculture, in which he outlined three key elements in contemporary, then contemporary, popular culture in America. New techniques in therapy, well, it's not quite sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It's therapy, drugs, and rock and roll. But the issue for this counterculture, the new techniques in therapy were basically came out of humanistic psychology. Abraham Maslow and his hierarchy of needs and what he called peak experiences, yes. Viktor Frankl with logotherapy, which was kind of a psychology of meaning. Frankl was an Auschwitz survivor. And Eric Fromm also struggled under Nazi rule, but he ended up writing The Art of Loving, and several other books. These are humanist psychologists. Viktor Frankl, Rollo May, Carl Rogers, Virginia Satir, who's kind of laid the foundations for family therapy. All of these people suggested that there were ways that you could really get deep inside and open up human potential movement that bloomed out of this, and really become liberated, creative people. No need for God in the process. But you might benefit from drugs as a means to reach for alternative consciousness. So was the countercultural mythos. And music was a big part of it too. So, as I said, Jim Morrison. Watson, this author, goes into modern art a lot. Impressionism's ways of helping us recognize everyone's unique viewpoint in the world. And later on, abstract expressionism's focus on how a work of art makes us feel. You see de Kooning or something like that, you go, wow, but what does it make you feel? You know, what's your response to this? Because it's so paranormal in a way, the imagery, or, Paul Klee or any of these, it's a little bit, you just respond emotionally, and that's what they want. Then there are, in the realm of atheism, another school, the evolutionary biologists, typified by Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, and Sam Harris. Their use of combative language can be off-putting, but it comes out of the sincere belief that the theory of evolution is the big idea of our time, and people who miss its significance are essentially missing everything. So they kind of come off as evangelists for Darwin. I've been given books by all three authors. They're okay. But one wishes that Dennett and Harris, Dawkins is, not Dawkins, he is better about this, but Dennett and Harris, he wishes they'd read the phenomenologists and put as much energy into understanding that approach as they want everyone else to put into understanding science. It's also interesting to me how each of these brilliant scientists finds all kinds of meaning in the science that they study and repeatedly express their awe at the sublimity they see everywhere. But hey, they're scientists. Scientists love science just as English majors love William Butler Yeats, Rainer Maria Rilke, and Virginia Woolf. All atheists, according to Peter Watson. So there is much one can say about this subject. We have no time this morning to do more than scratch the surface. So much has happened in the last, and so much has been learned in the last 135 years. It's worth noting that while all these budding ideas have emerged regarding the universe and how people fit into it, ideas about life without God. It's worth noting that throughout the same period, ideas about God have also been changing, in some cases, quite radically. Modern theologians have, for instance, suggested that God may not be omniscient, after all, or all-powerful, or always wholly good, or wholly perfect, or even paying attention. This is not the God of Billy Graham, that's for sure. But it was the God of my favorite seminary professor, Bernie Loomer, a process theologian who left the Baptist Church for the Unitarian Universalists. Professor Loomer believed all the qualifying attributes of God that I just listed, or he believed none of them, okay, all-powerful, omniscient, none of them. But he still considered himself a theist, even if process theology itself came entirely out of the work of Alfred North Whitehead, according to Watson, a full-blown atheist. My main point this morning is not to convince anyone to become an atheist or to abandon that stance. My main point is that among Unitarian Universalists, it's less important what you believe than that you keep wrestling with these ideas and keep trying to refine your thinking, get it clearer. And we learn new stuff all the time, so you got to keep sorting it through. Unlike the Orthodox of virtually every other tradition, we ask that you risk confessing your faith to yourself and to one another, which means finding it first. We ask that you conduct this search, the search of a lifetime, with integrity and courage to wrestle God, or whatever you think might be God or could have been God, wrestle that energy to the ground and tell us in the morning who won. We ask you to abandon easy blind beliefs and dare to discover your own questions. It is a lot to ask, admittedly. And the truth is, that's only the ante. That's just the beginning. But that's what you're signing up for when you become a Unitarian Universalist. So, what do you believe? How does a deity fit into your view? I hope to lead an adult religious education seminar this coming winter to help stimulate that inquiry among us, help each person who enrolls to come to their own self-expressive, poetic take on it all, God or no God. So maybe, amen and shalom.